Accession number 3936, reel 3.
Mr. Fleece, reel 3. Could you tell me about the end of your voyage, then?
Well, the end of the voyage was... we settled down to a certain routine. I found somebody with whom I could talk economics, because I was very interested in all problems of economics, which I studied later in the camp. And... we settled down to a certain routine, not a very pleasant routine, as I told you. And when we arrived in Perth, the rumor went round, which was confirmed later as true, that a group of Australian officers came on board who obviously had heard before what had happened on the ship. You see, we landed in Cape Town and something was smuggled out there, I suppose, some report. And... the leader of the foreship, whom we didn't know, Dr. Wiener, a solicitor, had prepared in his mind a statement what to say. And so in very few words, he told the Australian officers what happened. And his Lieutenant O'Neill was present. And he said, if you say one more word, I'll shoot you. And he drew his revolver. But Dr. Wiener was courageous enough to carry on quietly and finished, and he was led back to his quarters. And during the night, another, or the same group of Australian officers came to verify whether it was true. And I remember they came to our quarters, and all they said was horrible, horrible. And that was all I remember. Then we made for Melbourne, where we got rid of the Nazis. They were interned in a separate camp there. And we went then on to Sydney. It took another 2 days. And that was the end of our suffering, really. Because except for a few words of abuse by somebody, we were escorted by Australian soldiers, pretty ancient ones, probably those which were not who were not useful for war services, to our train. And it's, you know, it's a strange feeling. You haven't to make any more decisions. You are told where to go, where to sit, you know, what to take. And we got nice food. Everybody got a little carton with very daintily made up food and fruit. And they gave us cigarettes, and they chatted with us, and it was already very nice.
What condition were you in at this point?
Pretty grim. We were still in tatters, and the soldiers told me we were a horrible sight. We were used to ourselves, of course. We saw each other every day, all day long. But they must have been pretty shattered. And one chap said that when one boy came down with hollow cheeks and big eyes, like, you know, these starvation pictures you see sometimes. And he looked at the same face as his grandson, and he was terribly shocked.
When you disembarked, did they give you back what remained?
No, nothing at all. No, we were still in our what we had, and then we traveled through the whole night and arrived in the morning. Brilliant sunshine. I never forget that view. We were all lined up in a big line. 2,000 people, and they tried to count us, which was impossible, of course. Unruly Jews running about all the time. And eventually, the sergeant major saluted smartly to the colonel and said, approximately 2,000. In front of us was a camp. We were not in the camp. Then we were lined up before. The camp looked absolutely new. The barbed wire shown like silver-plated. And there were two mounted soldiers, and when they galloped from one side to another, everything was in a cloud of dust. And then we were lined up for breakfast, and that is a thing which I never forgot. We were lined up, and it was my turn. Each one was given a mug of tea, a pannikin, it's a tin mug of tea, and a slice of bread, actually two slices, about an inch thick, and an inch of bully beef in between. And being a vegetarian, I took it the meat out and gave it to my chap behind me. They were all starved and were very glad of it. But the officer saw it and shouted at me, "Only meat not good enough for you?" I said, "Well, I'm sorry, sir, I happen to be a vegetarian." "What?" he said. "In Australia, we eat meat five times a day. You stand there." So I stood there. Then he took his uniform off and made me two tomato sandwiches. That was really something wonderful. And then we were led into our camp. We were directed into our huts. We had no choice. I met my old friends again who were at the foreship, my political friends who were not Jews, who were interned all from the same group. And then we were left to ourselves.
Is this Camp 7, 8?
That was Camp 8.
Okay.
Well, it was, first we were all in, it was all first Camp 7, A and B, and then in order to get this record straight, they made one Camp 7 and one 8. We were only about 100 feet apart. But we were separate, and we were not supposed to have any connection with each other. And now a very interesting time started, which I found particularly interesting in retrospect when I thought about it. The huts were entirely empty. We were about 30 huts. I don't know the exact number anymore. And all those people who have been through a war or through other internment camps or prison or something, they knew exactly what to do. The first thing they did, they dived under the huts, because there's where they found all sorts of interesting things which the workmen left behind. Nails, hammer, and things which one uses. You know, we had nothing to put even when we went to bed. Our trousers on, you know, went all on the floor. We slept on straw palliasses, which are quite comfortable. 42 a hut. The bunks were on top of each other in two long rows. Pretty noisy, of course, and nothing else. Absolutely nothing else. Now, the first thing, of course, to take a nail, which they found, and borrow the hammer and put a nail into the wall, and that was our property then, strictly guarded as property, which nobody else was going to touch. And when we wanted to change places, you see, I wanted to be together with my friends. It was a major operation between ourselves.
I take it you had bunk beds.
Bunk beds, yes. Well, you can't call them beds. Bunks.
Yes.
Just wooden bunks with a straw palliasse.
All in great rows, or was there any sort of partition?
No. In two rows, you have to imagine two rows in the middle of the hut with a fairly wide gangway on each side and a boarding in the middle so that people could not roll over into the other bed. And rows at 10, the whole length, 10 on top and then 20 the other side in the same arrangement. Now, we had absolutely nothing. Now, I have to go back a little. One of my political friends who was in the foreship, he found out that the communists had plotted to take over the camp and run it along communist lines. They had it all mapped up very exactly, who did what and who was to become a camp leader, who had to be proposed as camp leader, who had to be second to be camp leader, and so on. And particularly, who, what person had what position. They knew what positions were needed, cleaning, particularly the latrine cleaning, where they were sure nobody else would volunteer for it. So they had it all mapped up, and it worked.
What proportion would you say were communists?
Oh, very small, very small. Most of them were just unpolitical Jews, and then we had some political people, like my friends, who were socialists, but very strongly anti-fascist and very strongly anti-communist. They didn't want it. And so we worked against this because they had even their own police for beating up people who didn't want to obey, you know, the orders. It was really, if you know Animal Farm by George Orwell,
yes,
exactly the same. It was organized in the same way. But that didn't last long because one of my friends, who was very active, he did it very cleverly. He went into every hut and said, now you have to elect a hut leader. I don't mind whom you elect, as long as it's not a communist, and such person is a communist. Nobody wanted communists, so we had 36, I think, or 25, I don't know, hut leaders. I was one of them, too. And we were elected to what they call the camp parliament. And we had to elect democratically our leader, and we elected the chap who was so courageous in Perth and who told the Australian officers, Dr. Wiener. Excellent chap. And from then, the communists still tried to carry on, so the latrines were still cleaned. But eventually we got hold of the whole organization, and now we had to organize it. And as you probably know, we had a great number of very talented people in all spheres of life. And the chap who saved the whole who saved the situation and who organized it, I forgot his name, he was a banker, a merchant banker, and he knew how to organize it. So he persuaded one of the officers, the same officer who made the tomato sandwiches, with whom we became very, very friendly, that very intelligent chap. You can't say that of all Australian officers. He really took the risk and lent us 10,000 cigarettes. Or he gave us 10,000 cigarettes, hoping that he would get the money back sometime. And this banker organized it in such a way that he employed a few people to make money. This was done in a fairly primitive but intelligent way. We took toilet paper, cut it in four so that it was easy, usable as money. One of our artists took a large potato, cut it in half, and carved a design on it. It was just the side view of one of our huts, and borrowed some aniline dye from one of the officers, I suppose, or from the paymaster, and stamped it, and then a few people were engaged to number them and put a value on it, sixpence or a shilling, old sixpences, old shillings. And those people who had bank accounts somewhere, like myself and my brother, could buy these in little booklets of two sixpences and two shillings and so on. And we could buy cigarettes for them. And everybody who did some work for the camp, except the cooks, because they were all flocking into the kitchen as starved as we were, and if they worked for it, particularly the latrine cleaners, they got very well paid. And some of the communists carried on for money, why not? And some other people volunteered. And we soon saw to it, we formed what was called, or we had very highbrow name for everything. The assembly of, as I told you, of the Hut leader was called the parliament, you know, and the various departments were called ministries. We had soon a ministry, a social service ministry, who saw to it that people who had no money whatsoever, nothing to fall back, they got some free cigarettes, or they got some free money, really, so that they could buy something. And as soon as people found out that you really can buy something, the canteen had suddenly money, paper money. And for that paper money, they could then, they exchanged our checks, which we gave them, or our IOUs, to the paymaster, who really got real money from that, from England eventually. So the thing developed slowly, and we could buy toothpaste. This was the second one, which we were out of toothpaste for eight weeks, and other small things which we wanted. And gradually there developed a camp life which was really absolutely marvelous.
Why should you take the extra step of using play money instead of just using real money?
Oh, we were not allowed to. I'm sorry, I didn't tell you that. No, from the day the money was taken away from us in England already, we had no money whatsoever.
What's the difference? I suppose the reason is you might escape. And if
yes,
you had money,
yes, of course, or may bribe somebody or so. And we were supplied with all the necessities. We had a shelter. We had nothing to wear in Australia. But even there, the Jewish welfare organization in Sydney were informed the plight we were in, and they sent us huge boxes with old clothes, which were a godsend. But one chap in our camp, somehow he was known as the Wise Solomon, so to speak. He was entrusted with the distribution of these clothes, and they had to come to him and claim. And then our suitcases came back, anyhow what was left of them. I had still my suit in it and one or two other things which were useful. My brother had nothing what belonged to him, so he gave it into the general fund, and it was distributed according to his two needs. And everybody thought, now what could I do to make a little bit of money so that I can buy things in the canteen? And then we started to having nearly everything which normally a camp had. We had even great luxuries. We started a Vienna cafe. We had the rations were plentiful. You see, according to the Red Cross, we have to get the same rations as the Australian soldiers, and their rations were absolutely ample, including tobacco. And
if you then had a tobacco ration, you wouldn't, and all these splendid rations, you wouldn't then need the canteen.
Not for eating. No, but for other necessities like writing paper or books. We wanted books to read. We had nothing whatsoever. And all these little things which one needs.
Maybe it's just the idea of having some money and some control over what you do.
That's exactly it, you see, that there was a certain sector of freedom in the camp, you know, where you could do with your money what you liked. You were not told you have to eat this and you have to eat this. We could go short on the evening meal and go rather into the Vienna cafe and have some of the delicacies our Viennese pâtissiers supplied there. And we had a little music band. We got paid for it. And they played Viennese music. And it was interesting that the Australian officers, they liked it no end. They spent a lot of their good money. They bought our camp money and then took place in theater parties. And they called it a university. I took lessons in economics, as I told you, but you could learn Chinese and French and Russian, whatever you like, mathematics. We had many young people who wanted to carry on their studies, and we could supply this. And give you his name. He was Otto Benjamin, or Wise Solomon. He was, of course, Minister of Justice then. And he organized all the camp workshops. We had workshops for everything. We had tailors. They did repairs. And what was very useful, we got army supplies eventually. For instance, we got thick gray flannel shirts. And imagine in a heat of 100 degrees. So they got some very light cotton material. This Australian called it calico. And they made very nice shirts with short sleeves and short trousers. And so we were all running around who can ever afford it. They had to work for it, perhaps, sometimes. Except the medical hut, the kitchens, the Viennese cafe, he had everything in control. I gave you his name, Otto Benjamin, because when he went back to Germany, he immediately got a post as burgomaster, and he was eventually the Ministry of Interior of the Land Hesse, Lower Saxony, for 12 years until he retired.
With these desirable things that you could buy with the fake money, was there any problem of stealing?
If
you really wanted
so.
A shirt, you could perhaps do well
no,
to take someone else's
I
money.
I know I didn't bother about it because that was all dealt by our Minister of Justice, by Otto Benjamin, and he generally settled the things. I don't think there was any pilfering. I mean, occasionally something went astray. We had a very nice shop for art things. They made beautiful things, which they generally sold also to the Australian soldiers and officers. And so we got plenty of money, and we bought sporting equipment. We had two football clubs, one German, one Austrian. The German was called by the Austrian the Prussian. And we always hoped, anyhow, those which, who were not really part of the equipment, we always wished that the Austrians would win, because the Austrian, most of the kitchen staff was Austrian, and the food was lousy if they lost. I think I told you already, I started a vegetarian kitchen.
Yes. But we haven't recorded anything on that yet.
Oh, I see. Soon.
How long did that take?
Hmm?
How long did that take to start up?
Oh, I think 2 or 3 days only, because after the third day, I asked the Captain Carrington, that's the one who made my tomato sandwiches and gave us the cigarettes, whether I could do it. And he said, well, if you get sufficient stuff from your ordinary kitchen, that's fine with me. Under the condition that you also supply the medical hut with special diets. Can you do that? And I said yes, hoping I could. Went all right. And we started a vegetarian kitchen. For my sins, I tried to make it particularly good, so our number of vegetarians increased rapidly. But after a time, I was fed up with it, and I got a touch of claustrophobia. I had the feeling, you know, there's something that you can't get out of that camp. And I volunteered for work outside. And I did, for the rest of my stay in Hay, I worked in the Colonel's garden. And my friend, who was interned with me from the restaurant, took over the kitchen then.
About how many people were vegetarians?
We started with 20, and we were soon up to 100. And some officers came and asked whether they could partake. We cooked reasonably well. It was a bit difficult because we wanted, for instance, to make salads. But the Australian Russian didn't provide for oil or vinegar. So what should we do for salad dressing? But we had a butter mountain, so to speak. So we used the butter for making some oily substance, and we used the liquid of the pickles, which we got amply, as salad dressing. And I tried to not only to cook well and to present decent meals, but also to arrange them nicely. And that makes an awful lot of difference, particularly in a camp where everybody lets himself go. You see, we were, I think, 1,000 people roughly, all men, never a woman inside. So they said, why bother? You see, they didn't shave, they stayed in bed if they didn't want to get any money and work for it. And we tried everything to increase their interest in the camp activities, of course. And a nicely prepared meal was a great attraction.
Did the food they provided suit Austrian and German tastes?
Oh, yes. Yes, by and large. Yes. You see, we could do what we liked with it. As long as the Australian said, as long as we don't get any complaints, you can do what you like. And we had an Austrian chef, excellent. Except that after a time when our number in the vegetarian department reached 100, the others complained. They said, we eat all their vegetables away and they have too much meat. But still, that was not very serious.
How long was it that you kept up with the restaurant before you...
Before I went into the garden?
Yes.
About 4 or 5 months. And then my deputy took over. He was even a better cook than I was. I was more the administrator in our restaurant, but he was in the kitchen. No, he was excellent.
I would imagine that in a life like this, in a prison camp, it's all fairly routine, and eating would be one of the highlights of the day.
In a way, yes. There were some people who waited from one meal to another. And these were actually the poor people who had to be really... It's a pity, you know, if you do nothing else but wait from one meal to another. We eventually got books, partly we could order them, whatever book I ordered quite a number. I even ordered a typewriter, and the canteen got it for me. I had to pay with an IOU on my bank.
Were you able to have as much access to your English account as you wanted?
Yes, absolutely. But I didn't need much. Yes.